Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. The CIA director says his agency destroyed two videos showing harsh interrogations of al-Qaeda suspects. The president reacts to a surprising national intelligence estimate on Iran. Senate Democrats give in on fixing the alternative minimum tax. And Mitt Romney goes for his JFK moment on faith. Joining me to talk about these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, David Gregory of NBC News, Susan Page of USA Today, and Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8255. 8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Let's talk about the New York Times story uncovering the fact that apparently CIA destroyed two videos showing the interrogation of al-Qaeda suspect. What did the paper report? What has CIA Director Michael Hayden said about it, David?
Well, these were tapes of interrogations of prime al-Qaeda suspects that date back, obviously, to 2002, post 9/11, and that the tapes themselves demonstrated some of the techniques that have become so controversial, that have been debated within Congress, that have also been the study of the 9/11 Commission, and indeed been central to the case of thought to be the 20th hijacker, Massawi. And those tapes, at least a couple of them, have been destroyed. And the principal concern on the part of CIA Director Michael Hayden was protecting the CIA officers involved from potential litigation. The question is twofold. Did they deny these critical materials to the existence of them to ongoing investigations? And two, it again refocuses attention on the interrogation techniques themselves. And is there, in a sense, a cover-up of those techniques to shield them from the debate?
Susan.
Causing particular controversy because at the time they were destroyed, it was a time as 9/11 Commission was investigating. There were lawsuits that had been filed about interrogation techniques. Clearly, a lot of interest on the part in the courts and by the Congress about what interrogation techniques had been used, and yet we knew nothing about these tapes, and virtually no one outside the administration knew about the existence of these tapes at the time they were destroyed. So a lot of suspicion on why they were destroyed, and whether they would have come to light if the New York Times hadn't broken this story. Now, the CIA did something interesting yesterday. The Times informed them Wednesday night that they were going to go with the story, so they announced it on Thursday, which denies the Times kind of the scoop that they had in the works.
Doesn't seem to me anything except the question of who was denied these tapes. I mean, is that very critical here, Jerry?
I think in a legal sense it is, and I think the question will be what was the CIA, what was the administration asked? And was the question asked and interpreted so narrowly that they had a legal basis for not disclosing the existence of the tapes? I mean, there was a point in court proceedings in the Massawi case in which lawyers from Massawi asked for tapes of interrogation of certain suspects who might have been able to corroborate Massawi's story that he was not involved. And they were told, apparently, those tapes did not exist. Now, that may be a technically correct answer because they weren't the very tapes that were made by the CIA. I think the broader, more political question is actually has to do with, as Susan mentioned, the 9/11 Commission. And the 9/11 Commission basically went in with a very sort of broad request, give us all the information you have about lots of things, including interrogations. And I think as a political as opposed to a legal matter, there may be a question of whether at that point the CIA was under some obligation, or at least it would have been politically wise to explain this to the 9/11 Commission, leaving aside the courts and the lawyers.
The other part of this political debate is that a lot of these interrogation techniques have been shrouded in secrecy deliberately by the administration with the creation of secret prisons and with a set of rules of conduct for CIA officers. And the argument being that when you have detainees who are trained to withhold information and to resist interrogation techniques that we should keep secret, that which officers might actually employ in this ongoing war on terror. This is a political debate about how far even CIA officers should be going.
David Gregory, White House correspondent for NBC News, Jerry Seib, Washington Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. The phones are open, 800-433-8850. One last question on that, Susan. What could be the fallout? Is there a possibility that individuals could be charged with obstruction of justice?
You know, I think we need to know more about whether these were tapes that ought to have been turned over in a legal sense. But I agree with Jerry that there's big political problems here. And in fact, we saw a House Senate conference just yesterday approve a bill that would outlaw waterboarding, would bring the interrogation by the CIA into line with the rules that govern the military. This is an issue that has not been resolved yet, and it's one that continues to roil Washington.
So what kind of investigation are we likely to see about these tapes,
well,
Jerry?
Well, in the first instance, you're certainly going to see a congressional investigation. There's already talk of a joint congressional investigative committee, House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats. I think that's probably a given. You may see the 9/11 Commission reopen the question here. One of the interesting political aspects of this was the CIA's assertion that the Intelligence Committee leaders in the House and Senate were told of these tapes and were told of their destruction, which was instantly denied yesterday by people on the Hill, including Republicans who were leading the committees at the time.
The Jay Rockefeller said that he had been informed of the existence of the tapes and then had been told that they were about to be destroyed, but never was told by the CIA that they had been destroyed. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics
that
of what his reaction was.
That was on NPR this morning,
I think the problem for in sorting this out was that Peter Hoekstra, who was the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee at the time, asserted he knew neither of the existence of the tapes or of their destruction. So, you know, this has been actually a fairly common occurrence here in which intelligence agencies have over the last few years told the public that they briefed congressional committees and then congressional leaders, and congressional leaders often say, well, we weren't told or we weren't really told that.
I mean, this happened on the prison issue as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't forget.
And on the warrantless wiretaps.
Right.
I mean, I don't know who's misremembering what, but it happens periodically now, and it's frustrating when you're in the business of trying to figure out who knew and when did they know it.
All right, let's talk about the release of the National Intelligence Estimate on Iran. That made a huge splash this week, Susan. Tell us what it said.
Well, it said that there was a high degree of confidence by 14 of the 16 spy agencies that Iran, in fact, did not have a nuclear weapons program, that it had been stopped as of 2003. And this is just 2 years after there was a national intelligence estimate that said there was a lot of confidence that they did have one. So it's an incredible reversal, and it goes to the heart of what has turned out to be perhaps the leading foreign policy issue for the end of the Bush administration, which was what to do about Iran's nuclear program. There's been all kinds of saber rattling that led us to believe there might be a military strike on Iran because of their nuclear weapons program. Now, U.S. Intelligence Agency said they believe there is not one.
How is there this flip-flop, David?
Well, there's new evidence. The president called it a great discovery on the part of intelligence. If you read the reporting and talk to people in the intelligence world, they also say that there was some reevaluation of information that they had, a set of fresh eyes. Hardliners within the administration will argue that this was sabotage on the part of the intelligence community, sort of payback for Iraq. So there could be competing agendas, new information. But the reality was that what they deemed was a high probability of a covert weapons program in 2005 is now deemed to be something that was shut down based on reportedly notes and intercepts of phone calls that were discovered. What has not changed, and this is important, though difficult for the administration to put out there, is that it's believed that the enrichment of uranium continues. And it kind of gets lost in this debate because that's what everybody's worried about. It's what the Europeans are worried about. It's what the Russians share a concern about. The Chinese are a little bit more difficult to pin down on these matters. And that's why you saw the president after the press conference come out and say they're still enriching uranium and they had a program at one time.
Yeah, sure. And that's exactly what I think the president was trying to say amid the din over this report, which is they are still there's every sign the Iranians are continuing to accumulate nuclear material. They also have been busy accumulating the knowledge about how to turn that into weapons. And so if you have those two things, you still have an Iranian nuclear threat. That message sort of got drowned out by the shock over the change in the assessment. It is one thing to have a nuclear weapons program. It's another thing to have an enrichment program. And David's right, what people were worried about most in the Iranian case was the enrichment program, which is still there.
But at the least, this delays the timetable that we see for when Iran could develop a nuclear weapon. It puts it down the road a couple years. It undermines the political support that might have been there for military action against Iran in the next year. And the problem, I thought, with the president's news conference was that he didn't seem to acknowledge there had been any change at all.
Yeah. Right.
That led to a lot of frustration and follow-up questions on the part of reporters. David, I bet you were there.
Yes, I was. But I asked a different question that I think is germane here, which is when the president speaks about World War III related to Iran, when he spoke about a mushroom cloud related to Iraq and there were no WMD, he will get accused of hyping the threat. Now, you could say just because George W. Bush says it doesn't mean it's not true. And in the case of Iran, there's a significant threat. The issue of why, when he was told in August, there was new intelligence pointing to a halted program, that he didn't tone down the rhetoric, I think leaves a lot of critics cold.
David Gregory, White House correspondent for NBC News. We'll take a short break. When we come back, questions, comments, more news. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Friday News Roundup, this week with Susan Page of USA Today, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, and David Gregory of NBC News. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jerry Seib, President Bush announced a deal for some homeowners at risk of foreclosure. Who qualifies? Who doesn't? It sounds confusing.
It is confusing, and it'll be controversial. The idea, first of all, the problem is that somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million mortgages will reset next year, which is to say that the interest rates, which started low, will go very high and will certainly make some of those people unable to meet their mortgage payments. The idea here was to use the moral suasion and the bully pulpit of the government to convince people in the mortgage industry to do something about it without being ordered or legally required to do something. And that something was to agree to freeze the increases in mortgage payments for some subset of those people for 5 years. The question is, who qualifies and who doesn't, as you say. The idea was to set criteria that will isolate the people who can keep their homes, make their payments if they get some help in the way of a mortgage freeze, not to make it qualify to people who can get by, who will get by anyway, or to give the break to people who are basically lost causes, who are going to lose their homes because they clearly shouldn't have bought them in the first place. A great question, and the one that's not clearly answered yet, is how many people fit those criteria? What percentage of the people whose mortgages will be reset next year? Not clear, and there's argument about how wide this net will go.
And why did the administration decide to go this way, Susan?
Well, I think the administration decided they had to do something because of fears that this foreclosure crisis is going to drag the whole economy into a recession next year. Really serious consequences for everybody, not just the people who have these subprime mortgages.
Didn't Secretary of Treasury Paulson get dragged into this kicking and screaming?
Well, it's certainly something that I think Republican administrations are loath to do, which is to interfere in the market. And you do hear a lot of sort of ant versus the grasshopper complaints. You know, the people who were careful and didn't take these mortgages or
didn't
saved
buy
up
more than
didn't
they
buy
could
more
afford.
Than they could afford aren't getting help. The people who are getting help are people who took out loans that they could not repay the way they were going to unfold. But I think the reason that the administration was willing to do this against the objections of free marketeers is the concern about the overall economic effect this housing crisis is having.
And to that point, the scope of the problem is not something that everybody really understands. That we talk about the subprime market being affecting relatively few people and the number of foreclosures not being that high, it is still significant enough that major lenders in this country are having to put on their books major losses. That impacts how banks lend to each other and whether they lend to each other. It also affects whether banks can free up any other capital to lend in other matters. So it's twofold. One is that you have people who are overly leveraged and who can't tap into that equity because housing prices have come down and who aren't going to be able to make payments. And then you have the issue of, is it going to get worse? Housing prices have dropped precipitously. They are likely to drop further. And that's the crisis that the government and the industries are trying to head off.
So how might this likely affect the Fed's decision next week on lowering interest rates, Jerry?
Well, you know, the Fed has a lot of cross currents that right now, you know, the real danger in this politically and from the Fed's point of view is that this problem could easily tip the whole economy into a recession next year, and has global consequences as well, because there's a contagion danger here that this spreads. You've seen it, so the credit squeeze hit other countries already. So the Fed probably wants to move aggressively to stop that, obviously. It now needs to calculate whether this fix is enough to sort of stem the tide a little bit and make it less urgent that they act in a big way. It also has a problem because if it cuts interest rates too aggressively, the dollar is already falling. That will make the dollar fall further. It's got to decide what are the consequences on the downside of a big interest rate cut. You're clearly going to get an interest rate cut, or it seems you will. How big is, I think, open to question.
There's also a question about the bang for your buck for investors. You know, a lot of these loans get bundled together or securitized, and then they get sold as debt to mostly foreign buyers. And that being the case, it's a question of the return that those foreign buyers, like in China, are going to get on that investment. Are they less likely to invest? That's a concern. And then it's, you know, all of this is about sort of calming a roiling market, which is worried about the impact of this credit crisis and the mortgage crisis in the future and on the banks.
One piece of good news this morning: the unemployment rate remains stable 4.7%, but I know you want to make another comment.
You know, we've seen the effect not only on the global economy, but on neighborhoods. You see some of these neighborhoods in working class communities where house after house is now boarded up. And this is bad for, obviously, the families that were evicted, forced out in foreclosure. It's bad for their neighbors who may own their houses, not face foreclosure, but have an empty house next door. And it's not good for the lenders either, who are now getting nothing at all for their house. So the theory behind this deal is that everybody can give a little, and maybe there'll be some overall good from that.
All right, let's talk about the Supreme Court, which heard arguments this week in a major Guantanamo case. How is this case different from those that have gone before, David?
Well, I'll take a stab at this. This is not a direct area that I cover, but the question here is whether the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have a right to question their detention in federal courts, have a right to say, what am I being held for? Let me test the evidence against me. And this is about having habeas corpus rights, which we have as U.S. citizens. They are not U.S. citizens, the government will argue. They are enemy combatants scooped up off of a battlefield. They do not deserve those rights. But you heard from a majority on the Supreme Court, hey, wait a minute, you cannot hold anybody in this country for 6 years without telling them what they're being charged with. That's the rub. That's the debate. And, of course, Congress has allowed these military tribunals to go forward, but there's a question about their efficacy and how quickly they're actually getting to the task of charging and trying these detainees.
What did the hearing tell us about the way the justices might go?
Well, this is an issue that the court has dealt with, I guess, two or three times before, and clearly there's a clear split. Everyone thinks there are, let's see, four votes for the administration and four votes for the lawyers defending the detainees, and that Justice Kennedy is in the middle, and it's his decision, his view on this that is likely to determine which way it goes.
He didn't tip his hand at all.
He seemed, in the question, according to news accounts, in the questions he asked, he seemed uncomfortable with the way the system's working now. Some of these people have been held 6 years without charges being filed against them. But also wanting, from the interpretation of his questions, of course, to feel that you need to have some kind of practical solution that works for the United States and provides some additional protections for detainees.
What happens if the government loses his case, Jerry?
I think the big question that's hanging over all this, and that will become more acute if it loses this case, is whether this idea that came to being after the 9/11 attacks, that the way to deal with suspects here was to create an entirely separate and parallel military justice system, is really going to survive. It's been sort of eroded bit by bit by the courts, including the Supreme Court, and it may be that the overall effect of this is to push more and more of this action into the civilian court system or the existing military justice system, not this tribunal system that was set up as a separate entity.
But if the government wins, what happens? Do you just keep those people at Guantanamo?
I think in that case it becomes a political question, not a legal question. In the question of whether Congress steps in and says, okay, courts have spoken, but we're now going to speak as well. I think, to me at least, that would be the question.
Well, and also, let's see who gets elected president,
because
that would be a decision that new president would be making.
And there's a desire to shut down Guantanamo Bay, even by this president, whether people believe that or not. And one of the things that's just curious, and I don't have the answer for it, is that one of the things the president has said is, well, it's not so easy to get these countries from whence these prisoners have come to accept them back. Yet we have some of the petitioners in this case who are Bosnian, and in fact, the government has said, we will take them back and deal with them. So the disposition of Guantanamo Bay is at issue here, and I agree with Jerry and Susan that this will become a political question about sort of fast-tracking this and saying, okay, what's the intelligence value, and we need some sort of mechanism to deal with these prisoners, because this is an infinite war, the way it has been defined and prosecuted, and therefore we are either going to live with the notion of a Guantanamo Bay indefinitely or not.
Susan, on the campaign trail, Mitt Romney yesterday tackled the issue of his Mormon faith. How did he do? Did he put the issue to rest?
This is a speech Mitt Romney hoped he didn't have to deliver. I've interviewed both Mitt Romney and his wife on this question in recent months, and their hope was that they could get through Iowa and New Hampshire without giving the religion speech, that by meeting voters one-on-one, they could reassure people about his Mormon faith. That turned out clearly not to be possible with the coming on strong of Mike Huckabee, an ordained Baptist minister who is now has a narrow lead in Iowa and in a pullout yesterday has a lead in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So the Romney camp decided they had no choice but to give a speech that tried to deal with evangelical Christians' concerns about his Mormon faith and to give his view of what role religion ought to play in politics. And what he said was religious tolerance is important. We shouldn't say what religion a president needs to be. But he did not do what John Kennedy did in 1960 and say religion has no part in the public square in the presidential campaign.
It's very interesting. Is he just addressing evangelicals or is there a broader concern?
I think there is a broader concern, but I think what's unfortunate in this case is that at least at the moment, there is a narrow tactical concern, and that is that Mike Huckabee is not just gaining traction. He is marketing himself as the Christian candidate, which is code, because what that says is to evangelicals, you know that we evangelicals don't consider Mormons to be real Christians, and that's because of the Mormon belief in the physical attributes of Jesus and God, and because essentially they believe that the Book of Mormon supersedes the Bible. So there is a departure there. And so the argument is something that he has to deal with to say there should be no religious test. That seems to be the thrust of what his message was, even as he talked about the role of religious freedom in the society. But I think there's a larger question about what is it that concerns people about faith and discussion of faith in politics. And I think that there's frankly, for a lot of people, it's the unknown. Is this a cultish religion, Mormonism, in the view of some, that we don't know a lot about? Does that scare us? Did they feel that way about Catholicism? Would they feel that way about Judaism when you have minority representation of these faiths? Because it seems to me that one of the arguments from Romney was we are a country whose moral code was indeed founded on the idea of faith in leadership.
Jerry.
It's interesting. The one thing he didn't do was to try to explain Mormonism to the American public. That wasn't the point of the exercise. It was to say, I'm a person of faith. I am a Christian. That's more important than anything else. That's what voters need to know. The precise nature of my mm-hmm. faith is not really the issue. So I think the lingering questions that lots of people have about Mormonism that David referred to that are in the background, I think, for a lot of voters, not just evangelical Christians, are going to still be there.
Right? What do you make of the fact that he made the speech at the Bush Presidential Library in College Station,
Well, I think
Texas.
They wanted to echo as much as possible the John F. Kennedy speech in 1960, which took place in Houston. They looked for a Houston venue. The College Station is, I think it's about a two-hour drive from Houston, so put it in a general area.
Was there any suggestion of a Bush endorsement there?
Well, no, and even in the press release they sent out announcing that the speech was going to take place there, they said that the elder President Bush was not endorsing him.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. You mentioned Mike Huckabee, David. Some people are asking whether he's peaked too soon. Other people are asking about the release of a convicted rapist and to what extent he, Mike Huckabee, as governor, had something to do with it.
Right, and whether he paid proper attention to the record at the time in the case and warnings from prosecutors. Look, this is an appropriate examination of his record as governor that he is in part running on. Heretofore, he's been running on charm and humor and very strong debate performances, but now he's in a position where he is, I don't think he's speaking too soon. I think he's speaking just right from his point of view. If he's got a shot to win Iowa and gain some momentum, because he doesn't have a lot of money, he doesn't have a lot of infrastructure, what he's got is a good, strong campaign, and he's a campaigner, and he comes off as authentic and principled, and he's got a real strong base with evangelicals. But now, some tough questions, and we're going to see those down the stretch to Iowa.
You know, there's a pattern in politics in which people who cover it talk about it, which is that when a candidate gets serious, he or she gets frisked. And that's what's happening to Mike Huckabee. You don't get frisked if nobody takes you seriously, because why bother? But you know, this is an inevitable part of the cycle. When you look as if you're a credible potential nominee, people take a closer look at your record. That's what's happening with Mike Huckabee. One of his big problems in the primary has to do with economic conservatives in the Republican Party who really don't like him. They think he had a record in Arkansas as governor mm-hmm. as essentially a big taxer, which is a debatable point. But nonetheless, the most vicious attacks that have been leveled against Mike Huckabee come from economic conservatives within the Republican Party who think he's wrong on the tax issue, which is the one issue they really care about.
What about Democrats? Susan, the latest polls show Barack Obama ahead in Iowa, closing the gap on Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. What's going on here?
Hillary Clinton has been under attack by both Barack Obama and also John Edwards, and it's beginning to take a toll. In the USA Today Gallup poll this week, she was down 11 points in a month, which is the most precipitous drop by any candidate this year in that race. It's clearly a problem. And, you know, one of her problems is to respond to these attacks. That increases her negative ratings, which is one of her big problems. So, you know, she may come through this. You don't get to be president without going through some rough patches. She is definitely going through a rough patch at
this
point.
I must say, I enjoyed thoroughly the radio debate, as you might imagine. But it seemed to me that they were far more low-key. They weren't sort of performing for the camera.
Right.
It was a low-key debate.
I have a few thoughts. First of all, I think that the electorate now is really engaged for the first time. We've been covering this race, it seems like, for 7 years. And so there's been a lot of set pieces about name recognition and who's really on top. Now, in Iowa and New Hampshire, they're really getting down to it. And I think that the calculus on the Democratic side to try to see it from a voter perspective is a little bit different than the Republican side. Democrats feel like they're going to win, and they don't want to make a mistake here. And they're not sold on Hillary Clinton for a couple of reasons. Many people don't like her, don't trust her, and they don't like how Republicans are gearing up to take her down and fight against her. So you have this split between whether strength and experience is more important than the idea of change. Barack Obama has found his voice in this campaign. He's effectively attacking her on the issue of what her real experience is and what her judgment is. So I think those are the cross currents right now.
David Gregory of NBC News, Susan Page of USA Today, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal. When we come back, we'll open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. By the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. A national intelligence estimate finds Iran stopped work on a nuclear weapons program in 2003. Vice President Cheney says Iraq will be self-governing by 2009. And Defense Secretary Gates travels to Baghdad. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Thank you.
We're back, and it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Hannibal, Missouri. Good morning, Joanne. You're on the air.
Good morning. A preface. I am a very strong believer in the separation of church and state, and I'm also a big supporter of the fact that there's no religious litmus test for candidates. But I do wonder about something, and I hope your guests can comment. I need to listen through the phone because I'm having trouble with my radio.
Okay.
I'm looking at Mike Huckabee, who is a very attractive candidate in many ways, but I'm also looking at this current administration, which has politicized science to a degree unprecedented, at least in my memory. Somebody who does not believe in evolution, it seems to me, takes a particular stance with respect to science. And in this sense, I believe his religious beliefs should be open to scrutiny. And I wonder what his beliefs about evolution say about his beliefs about science and about how that would express itself in public policy, especially at a time when our global competitiveness will depend on real big investments in genuine science and research and technology.
Joanne, thanks for your call. Susan, you sat with Mike Huckabee recently.
On Friday, I spent the day in New Hampshire with him and interviewed him. You know, he was asked about this evolution question in a debate. You remember the moderator said, raise your hand if you don't believe in evolution, and he raised his hand. But he said the next day, the day after the debate, that while he believed in creationism, he didn't think it should be taught in the public schools. However, in the last week, he said that he thinks intelligent design ought to be taught in the public schools. So I think this is an area that is not just our listener who's going to have some concerns. He's going to have to address the set of issues.
And just a reminder, on Monday in our first hour, we'll be doing a piece on faith and politics.
And I'm really looking forward to that program because
Thank
I think
you.
This is really a very important question because, you know, I think that belief in public life is more about religious law and whether a leader would apply religious law to public policy, which, of course, the Constitution tries to separate. One's faith can inform and instruct one's moral code. It can also lead to a kind of certainty about life. And I think one of the criticisms of George Bush that you hear is that his faith may color his judgment in that it creates a certainty, a certitude about how he approaches issues that clouds outside points of view. So I think there's a mix of how one's faith impacts public life. I think we should not fear it, however, and we should openly discuss it, as you're going to do, so that we can sort of really define and ferret out people's views and how they would be brought to bear. And I think what's troubling about the Mitt Romney case is it's not a question of what he would or would not do. It's really about how people feel about Mormonism and does that make them uncomfortable. I think that's really the root of why this is an issue for him.
You know, I think what's changed in the last generation is that voters, leaving aside candidates, I think voters have come to expect candidates to talk about their faith at some level in a campaign. It's now just part of the package, so it can't be avoided. And I think the message that Mitt Romney was trying to get across was, I am a person of faith. I have strong personal beliefs. That's what you need to know about me. And voters want to know that people have some deeper faith that guides them. But that's, you don't need to know the details of my religion. And that's where it gets kind of tricky. And Mike Huckabee, you know, is about to walk into the same minefield in a certain way because people are going to want to know about what do you think about evolution. And it's, you know, he's a conservative Southern Baptist with certain beliefs that are now going to be explored.
This is a relatively recent phenomenon. You know, George H.W. Bush, who stood by Romney's side yesterday, did not talk at length about his religion when he ran in 1980. And in 1968, when Mitt Romney's father was running for president for the Republican nomination and for a time was the leading contender there, did not have big questions about his Mormonism. This is something that's happened as the Republican Party has become more dependent on this unified group of conservative Christian voters.
Joanne, I'm glad you called. Let's go now to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Diane. I hope you'll allow me the flexibility to change my comments. Your show is so terrific that you raise important points, and I was would like to comment on what I think is the grave situation facing our nation, and that is with respect to the new NIE assessment. The warmongering of this administration, and I will have to say I think it's been horribly enabled by the corporate media, is just appalling. And when we look at what happened with the NIE, where 16 separate intelligence agencies came to a unanimous consensus that Iran did not have a program in which they were pursuing a nuclear bomb, then you put that into the context of the administration trying to gin up the threat of Iran. I just heard David Gregory say Iran is a threat. And let me tell you, if we didn't know if they even had a nuclear program, we certainly didn't know where the facilities were. They were talking about bombing the country. In effect, they were going to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age. And for anyone to suggest that Iran, without a nuclear program, with limited military capability, in the Middle East, with no means by which to strike us, is a threat to the most powerful country in the United States, it's appalling.
With all due respect, sir, a couple of points. First of all, for those who accuse the corporate media of enabling this president, a charge I've heard about 100 times, it strikes me that a lot of the points that you tick off to underscore your argument are most likely things that you have picked up from the media. And I think reporting out the intricacies of the story. Number two, it's not my judgment that Iran is a threat. It is not only this administration's. It is shared by the Russians, by the Chinese, by the French, by the Germans, by Great Britain, and others. Thirdly, Iran does have an existing military capability. The Iran Revolutionary Guard, which you may not know, has been active within Iraq. And there are 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq within ballistic missile zones of Iranian missiles. Furthermore, the U.S.'s top ally in the Middle East, which is Israel, is under an existential threat, they certainly believe, by an Iranian leader who has promised to wipe them off the face of the earth. So these are the concerns that the administration has, which are shared. And so I think that perhaps some of your views might be colored by your political views.
Of course, what's not shared by all those countries you mentioned is what to do about
it. That's precisely right. And I do think, again, I think one of the tough issues for this president is why the rhetoric about serious consequences, about warning of nuclear war, was not tamped down after they learned that the program had been halted in 2003. At a time when gentlemen like this and others do not believe this president
exactly.
And think that he's hyping a threat.
Actually, one thing that the intelligence estimate asserts is that diplomacy and economic sanctions worked in this case. Why did Iran stop its nuclear program in 2003? It's because they were making a cost-benefit analysis about whether to go forward or not. So that should be encouraging to those who seek to maintain the economic sanctions and perhaps even expand them, although that's going to be more difficult now, and to pursue diplomacy rather than
how
this military
much
action.
Diplomacy are we likely to see come out at this report?
I think you're going to see a lot of diplomacy, but now it's going to be different diplomacy. I mean, it's ironic. The Financial Times ran a story the day the NIE came out that said the Chinese had finally come around and decided to vote for tougher economic sanctions, another round, a third round of tougher economic sanctions on Iran at the Security Council. Well, that's been undermined by this national intelligence estimate. But you're still going to see lots of diplomacy. And I think it's important to know that the most vigorous actions the administration has been taking against Iran have nothing to do with military. They've been economic, and they've been pretty striking. It's an attempt to freeze Iran out of the international financial system. You know, I was speaking with a senior top administration official a couple of weeks ago who said he was visited recently by the ambassador from a country that has relations with Iran and has an embassy in Tehran. And this ambassador to Tehran said the single thing that deters the Iranians more than anything else is a 15-0 vote against Iran in the UN Security Council. So the message there was diplomacy and isolating Iran has a lot more effect than military threats.
Let's go now to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. One of the earlier callers, probably your first caller, brought up the issue that I think is extremely important in this election, which is the way that Huckabee probably would allow his faith to guide his policy decisions. I would suggest to your panel that one way that they could approach this, or that the media could approach this, would be to look at the expense to the U.S., the expense to people, the cost to communities of continuing to revisit again and again the issue of the teaching of evolution in public schools. Looking back at a case in Pennsylvania, for example, the case that was finally decided, I think, by a federal district court, how many millions of dollars were spent by the plaintiffs, by the federal government? How much did the school district have to invest, and how much did it lose just because they had to revisit this issue again, an issue that falls down upon bad science?
Susan.
Well, of course, this isn't up to the president of the United States. This isn't decisions made by local school boards. I'm from Kansas, and we've had one debate after another on the teaching of evolution and creationism in the public schools, and it's resulted in one set state school board after another being voted in and out of office.
Let's talk about what has and has not happened on Capitol Hill. The year is almost over. Democrats, Republicans clashing over a slew of unfinished business. Republicans got their way on the alternative minimum tax. What happened, Jerry?
What happened was that the Senate agreed to fix the alternative minimum tax, fix meaning to reduce its impact on middle-class voters for a year without having to come up with the money to pay for the lost revenue. And so that is now going to move to the House, where it appears the House, which had thought there should be offsetting tax increases in various ways, particularly on hedge funds and private equity firms, to pay, quote-unquote, pay for the lost revenue, probably going to drop that. So you're probably going to get a fix on the alternative minimum tax, which means it won't hit as many upper middle and middle class taxpayers as it would have otherwise for a year, while the AMT debate then resumes again next year. So, but it's a significant thing because we still are, and maybe we won't be in a few days, but we're on the verge of it being a serious problem for people who want to pay their taxes, because the IRS doesn't know what the tax rules are supposed to be next year until this is resolved. If it gets resolved in the next week, I think the IRS will be able to avoid a messy January.
How
problem.
Likely is it to be resolved?
It sounds likely. Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate leader, said he had been told yesterday the House would go along with this. I think as a political reality, nobody wants to leave town in either party without fixing the AMT. And so if that's what it takes to get it done, I suspect the House will go along.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Then there's the energy bill, Susan.
The House yesterday passed an energy bill that tightens fuel economy standards for cars for the first time in more than three decades. That's significant. And it also mandates that electric utilities start to generate more of their power from alternative sources. Now, this bill, unlike the AMT, which looks like it's going to have an agreement between the two branches, the two houses of Congress, is going to get a very tough ride in the Senate, likely to be significantly revised, and President Bush has threatened a veto of the version that the House passed.
But then there are 11 overdue spending bills. Who's going to get the blame for this?
No, we'll see. I mean, you know, the president's got the bully pulpit, and he's made a point of using December to attack the Democrats for not accomplishing anything, one of them having to do, of course, with war spending. And the Democrats would like a non-binding insert in that bill that would call for troop withdrawal by the end of 2008. Of course, the president doesn't want that, and he's got a little bit more leverage in this debate now because of the reduction in violence because of the surge, and is also threatening that there would be layoffs at the Pentagon and so on and so forth. And Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, says that he's not leveling with the American people. So all of this is still coming to a head, and there doesn't look to be a lot of room in the middle at the moment.
All right. To Guilford, Connecticut. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I'd like to give you some anecdotal evidence on this mortgage thing. In 1976, I bought a mortgage, and that was the first year that the adjustable rate mortgages came out. I asked, the rate was 7.25%, and I asked my counselor if he thought the rates were going to go up high, and he said, oh, no, they'll never reach double digits. We'll never say never. 5 years later, I got a letter from the bank saying that my mortgage rate went up to 16.25%. And believe me, my raises didn't even touch the increase in interest. And as most of you know, initially, most of the payment is not payment on principal, but it's an interest payment.
Right.
Now, my question is this. the president has suggested that 5 years from now, the rates remain stable. And what are they going to be by these? Bankers are greedy, believe me. What are the rates going to be 5 years from now?
Who knows?
Well, who
Jerry?
Knows? But yeah, I think the caller raises an interesting point that's gotten lost here. One of the purposes, and Hillary Clinton has talked about this as well on the campaign from the other side, one of the purposes of having a sort of a freeze is to allow people to refinance their homes and to get rid of these adjustable rate mortgages and to roll over into fixed rate mortgages mm-hmm. that they know with certainty what their financial obligations are. Part of the reason here is not simply to give people a pass for 5 years and then see what happens then, because that may be a bigger mess and you could just delay the inevitable. One of the things that has to happen now is there have to be some programs for people to actually, in the interim, refinance the mortgages so they get out of this box. And right. there needs to be probably some government help for that to happen.
Susan, one last question for you. Christmas is going to be in Iowa, practically.
That's right.
You've got all these primaries coming early in January. Really does mess up the holiday.
Well, it messes it up for reporters, but even more for these poor people in Iowa and New Hampshire who can't go Christmas shopping or go down the street or get a tree without running into a candidate.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, David Gregory, White House correspondent for NBC News. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Diane.
And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.